Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Pressurization start. X plus 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
That's the sound of the Jupiter C rocket launching on January 31st, 1958. It carried Explorer 1, the first American satellite successfully placed in Earth orbit. Now remember, at that time, the space race was on. The Russians had put Sputnik into space the year before, so the U.S. needed its best minds, almost all of whom, the ones that we've heard of at least, were men. But there was a group of little-known, extraordinary women whose fast, accurate, hand-cranked mathematical calculations provided essential support for America's earliest push into space. Nathalia Holt has written a new book about these women. It's called Rise of the Rocket Girls, the women who propelled us from missiles to the moon to Mars. And Nathalia Holt joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So tell us, first of all, a little bit more about who were the Rocket Girls and in 1958, where were they working?
So this is a group of women who were working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, and they were working as computers. So this is not a job title you hear much these days, but before all of the digital devices we have now, you actually needed people to do the calculations.
So these are people who actually were doing computational things, therefore they're called computers.
Exactly.
Now, how were they found by JPL? I mean, because clearly they had to have some extraordinary mathematical abilities.
They were all very skilled at math. Some of them had graduated from college, some of them hadn't. But JPL put out advertisements, computers wanted, and many of the women found out about the jobs that way. And then there was a woman supervisor named Macy Roberts, who was made supervisor in 1942, and she is the one that decided it should be an all-female team.
Okay, so tell us then more about the team and exactly what it did. Because, you know, I mean, I feel like I should just underscore here. We're talking about putting objects, satellites, and then later on human beings in space at a time where, I mean, the computational power of your iPhone, one iPhone is like a million times more than the existing machine computational power we had back in the 50s and 60s. So the importance of doing these hand calculations and doing them accurately can't really be overemphasized, right?
Yes, absolutely. It would take an entire day for the women to do a single trajectory of the rockets they were working on. And it's important to note here that there were early IBMs that were available in the 50s and 60s, but there was a lot of mistrust of these computers. And so there was this feeling that you wanted to have a human behind these calculations to make sure it was being done correctly.
Right. So they were calculating orbits, escape velocities, things like that by hand. Did they have any calculators or slide rules?
Yeah, so they used paper and pencil. They did use slide rules just in the beginning, and then they used something called a Friedan calculator, which is sort of this big boxy machine that's really loud and, quite frankly, can't do very much. It could do addition and subtraction. Later on, it could do square roots, and those were very prized by the women.
Now, you mentioned that they were called computers. Why weren't these women called engineers?
So there weren't very many women engineers at the time. So there are women that applied who had degrees in engineering. One of them is a woman named Jenez Lawson, who was the first African-American hired in a technical position at the lab. And she had a degree from UCLA in chemical engineering. Today, she would be hired as an engineer. But then she was made a computer. But what's really inspiring about this group of women is that they did later become engineers, and they really became the first computer programmers in the lab as well.
Well, so you mentioned a minute or two ago about a very key woman in all of this who was a supervisor of one of these teams, can I call it? Her name's Macy Roberts, right? Is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about Macy. Who was she? How did she become such a key figure at JPL?
So she was just very trusted by the founders of JPL. She started working for them very early on, and she was made supervisor because she was a little bit older than most of the other people there. It was still a very small kind of family group, so she was sort of seen as the mother hen. And she just decided that she wanted to hire all women because she wanted to have the lab keep its family feel. She wanted them to really be friends as well as coworkers. And she worried that if she hired a man, and there were men that applied for these jobs, but she worried that if she hired them, they would just not really listen to her because she was a woman.
In the book, you write that all it took was for her to see a man's name on an application, she would automatically reject it.
Yes. Today, this would be a lawsuit. Then it was okay.
Well, I'm speaking with Nathalia Holt. Her new book is Rise of the Rocket Girls, The Women Who Propelled Us from Missiles to the Moon to Mars. And she's telling us the extraordinary story about a group of women who literally were the brain trust that provided the hand calculations to help propel America's earliest efforts in space. Nathalia, if you could just hang on for one second, I want to bring in someone who you spoke to, who's part of this story. Her name is Susan Finley. She's currently a systems engineer at NASA. She's NASA's longest-serving woman and started as a human computer at JPL in Pasadena back in 1958. Susan Finley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
It's such a privilege to have you on this show. I am always so excited to speak with America's earliest pioneers in all their forms. So tell us, what first attracted you to working at JPL?
Well, because I was working at Convair as a computer, believe it or not, and it was 30 minutes away, and I had just gotten married, and my husband had graduated from Caltech, and he knew about the lab that Caltech had up at the top of the Arroyo called JPL. So I went there and applied, and they needed a computer. So they hired me right on the spot.
Yeah, and so I'm sorry, Susan, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I'm curious because, of course, I'm looking at this story from 2016 eyes, of course, and I just want to wonder, like, were gender differences obvious in the office? I mean, this was the 50s. I'm thinking Mad Men. They must have been. But, I mean, did it matter that you were a woman? I mean, how did the fact that you were a female computer play out in your daily work at JPL?
Interestingly enough, both at Convair and at JPL, we were always treated as equals. In my mind, we were partners, we were a team, and they needed us. So there was no problem. I won't say that about secretaries. I think secretaries have always had a problem, but the computers didn't.
Mm. Well, Nathalia, you tell a story in the book Rocket Girls about one of the first projects that Susan worked on at JPL, the launch of Pioneer 3. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, we had just gotten a little tiny desk computer that you programmed with wires. And for some reason, it wouldn't work that night, so they called me in to do the hand calculations using the Frieden, and we would get the information over the telephone from, I think, Wallops Island about the telemetry that the rocket was sending, and then I would figure out what its escape velocity was, and I would just, every new number, I would plug it in, and then the man standing behind me would call it over the radio to them, or the phone to them. And then we knew what the escape velocity had to be to get out of the atmosphere, and it kept slowing down and slowing down. And so we knew it wasn't going to make it. But it's, you know, a little nerve-wracking with somebody standing behind you while you're doing your calculations.
I can only imagine.
I do want to tell you something about this July. When the spacecraft Juno goes to Jupiter, I have refused to work in the mission support area. I'm going to work upstairs.
<There's> still memories of Pioneer 3 haunting you. Susan, hang on for just a second because I want to bring Nathalia Holt back into the conversation. So tell us more about this moment and what it tells us about the importance of the women who are doing these calculations.
Yes, so Pioneer 3, Explorer 1, all of these early moments in NASA's history they were just so critical to have the women there. They were part of developing the rockets, developing the fuel, and actually calculating the trajectories and mission control when they were happening. And it was just thrilling to learn how critical the women's roles were in all of this.
Susan, I'm seeing that the problem with the Pioneer 3 was that there was a third stage malfunction, so it never reached the escape velocity that it needed.
Yes, I guess so. We didn't know what the problem was at the time, of course.
So tell me a little bit about, and Nathalia, please feel free to jump in here anytime. There's some things I feel that never change, and one is the challenges of balancing work and family life. How did that work for you, Susan, in your earliest days at JPL?
That certainly was the biggest challenge, and it still is a challenge because the United States still doesn't have support for working families as far as the children go, and I think it's criminal. I don't know. I guess it's they still want the women at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, so did you feel that you got some kind of support from Macy Roberts, who we were talking about earlier, because she created this special team where it was at least all women working together?
Well, that was a lot easier then. I didn't have children then, but I still had a husband to take care of. And yes, it was very nice to have people to commiserate with.
And later, Helen Ling, who became supervisor a little bit after Macy Roberts retired, she carried on Macy's tradition of hiring only women. And then what she did that was also special is that after a woman would have a child, she would call them up and ask if they wanted to come back. And at a time before maternity leave, this was really critical into bringing working mothers back to the lab.
Mm. Susan Finley, tell us a little bit more about how your work evolved and grew from those early days in 1958 at JPL. Because as you probably heard, I asked Nathalia a little earlier, why is it that women at that time weren't called engineers, they were called computers? I mean, was there a point at the time where you realized or you knew that you should have had the title of engineer?
I guess I never thought that because I did not graduate from college. I only took a couple of math courses, and so I didn't feel that, especially that I deserved it, but I certainly was doing work at that level. And the third time I came back to work at JPL, they did hire me in as an engineer because I had had 4 years of experience on the job, and I had learned a lot, and so they did hire me in as an engineer.
Go ahead, Susan. I'm sorry.
But then they decided about, I think it's 12 years ago now, that anybody without a degree couldn't be an engineer. And they decided, I think, because some person might sue them for not giving them overtime.
Okay, so.
And I could never get them to send me those laws or whatever, but anyway.
Wait, I want to be sure I'm understanding this correct. Your title is engineer.
I'm a system engineer, yes. And I said that. I said, but that's what I do. And they said, well, that doesn't matter.
Wait, so is your title not officially engineer at NASA right now?
That's true. That is true.
Are you serious?
I am serious.
You've been working for NASA or for the American Space Program since 1958.
Yes. I'm not sure it was NASA that did it. I really think it was JPL that did it. I don't know that.
I'm agog right now.
Right. I officially do engineering work. Yeah. I I get to put it on my, well, I haven't taken it off of my business card.
Nor should you. Well, Natalia Holt, that was unexpected, Susan, but Natalia Holt, we've just got about a minute here left to go. Tell us what you think the story of Susan and the other Rocket Girls. Tell us about the role of women overall in terms of, you know, maybe like where we were and how far we've come. When it comes to not just space, but I mean, we're talking science and technology fields because, you know, once again, they are as important as ever.
Yes. So these are women that have had long careers at NASA. They've touched just about every mission you can think of. And they're important to us as role models for women. You know, right now, women in technology are facing a really difficult time. What we've seen is that in 1984, 37% of bachelor's degrees in computer science were awarded to women. And today that number has dropped to 18%. So it's a desperate time for women that are interested in computers and are interested in math. And it's important that we recognize our pioneers because they deserve the recognition. Certainly Sue Finley deserves much more recognition than she's received, and so do the other women, but also because of what they can bring for the next generation of women.
Hear, hear. Well, Natalia Holt is author of Rise of the Rocket Girls, The Women Who Propelled Us from Missiles to the Moon to Mars. It's a wonderful book, and thank you so much for helping us give these women the credit they deserve. Thank you so much, Natalia.
Thank you.
And Susan Finley, a systems engineer at NASA. She's NASA's longest-serving woman. I'm so proud to say that. Started as a human computer at JPL in 1958 and currently at work on the Juno mission, which is scheduled to arrive in Jupiter this July. Susan Finley, an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Don't let titles hold you down. That's my lesson for today. This is Radio Boston.